We're starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview the extraordinary Nathan Dufour, and then I play some of his remarkable song raps. He can be reached at Nathanology on social media. Stay tuned. It's September 13th, 2023. Mystic Pete here with Nathan Dufour, PhD, who I found on Instagram and have been enchanted with. Well, I've been enchanted with your videos, Nathan. Wonderful work you're doing. You are a poet, producer, and professor. Art about philosophy, ecology, and mental health. Welcome.
Thanks, Pete. It's nice to be here. I appreciate it. I'm glad you found me. Glad you found me where you found me. Nice to be here.
Tell me a little about your work.
Yeah, so I am a number of things. I've been trying to figure out a way to better condense my self-introduction because I often find myself stammering in these situations even when I'm on podcasts and stuff. I think I have this. I'm going to try it out. I'm an artist and an educator. I make creations of various kinds, oftentimes videos, songs, performances, and they usually have some sort of educational bent to them and usually some philosophical bent to them. So kind of imagine like Schoolhouse Rock, except a little bit more rap and very like densely philosophical and very urgently tied to the exigencies of the present cultural moment. That kind of thing.
You're not just one of these self-proclaimed experts who end up touting all kinds of nonsense conspiracy stuff. You're an actual PhD and a professor and educator, and I found your posts to be intelligent, eloquent, humorous, poetic, pointed, and just really well produced.
I appreciate that a lot. Yeah, it's a joy to do. I mean, I was teaching for a lot of years in institutional settings, and I was doing my music alongside it. I was like, okay, do I want to be a professor? Do I want to be a rapper? Do I want to be a philosopher? And then I came to my deep inner senses that those things could all be the same thing. And really, I'd sort of discovered that synthesis, not even from my own self-invention, but I view it as kind of a historical thing because really, if you look at a given civilization and look really early on at a given tradition of how education is transmitted, like if you look at the early philosophical tradition in the Western context, like you know Greco-Roman philosophy, or if you look at Far Eastern philosophy or Near Eastern philosophy or Indigenous American philosophy, in every case we have evidence of the sort of original form of the transmission of important ideas, like ideas about the nature of the universe or the identity of the community, what have you, things like this, always transmitted in a poetic form. And so I kind of realized that what I was doing all along was all part and parcel of the same thing. And so that's been the adventure ever since.
One of the things that really attracted me to your work is, well, very intelligent and very informative, but there's also a lot of puns and humor and rap. So it's engaging. And that sometimes is left out of some of the more politically aware discussions. Your stuff's fun.
I appreciate that. That makes me glad to hear.
Well, let's talk a little about your course, Philosophy for Ecological Action.
Yeah, I invented a philosophy course, an online philosophy course. And the reason, well, is I guess it just seemed like something like this should exist. So I mean, as I've kind of intimated already, I was teaching for a long time. And around the time that the pandemic hit, I was getting a little bit tired of the institutional setting because I felt like I was, as a teacher, I mean, it's a great job getting to teach because especially if you're, I was teaching at the college level. And so it's like, I'm talking about stuff that I care about deeply. I'm talking about philosophy. It's fun to talk about philosophy. What else is there to do in the world besides eating and sleeping and having sex, besides just contemplating the nature of existence and asking the unanswerable questions, et cetera, et cetera? It seems like the most natural thing to do. But doing it in an academic setting, it sometimes causes the flower of that experience to wilt a little bit because people are under obligation to be there, or the experience is being reduced to some sort of learning outcome, and that learning outcome is ultimately to get a grade, and that getting of a grade is to be applied to their success in getting a job or something like this. So it really creates a context in which it's not very fruitful to discuss these things. They're best discussed when it's elective and organic and just part of the natural outflowering of human desire and curiosity. So I was feeling blue about that. I was feeling icky about the task because I've been doing it for a lot of years. And then once it was on Zoom because of the pandemic, I was like, wow, this is really not what I want to be doing anymore. And so I wanted to create a course that is kind of like any other intro to philosophy course, except different in the sense that instead of cultivating the knowledge for its own sake, it's cultivating it in order to culminate in some kind of actual effect on your life, and specifically your life as an ecological being, because we're in a moment of such distinct ecological crisis. It's really the defining existential condition of our life, this notion that the world is heating up, the sea levels are rising, the ice caps are melting, a lot of stuff is on fire. These are quite distinct conditioning factors of our existence. And so the idea is that you take the course and sort of discover what your values are, like, oh, maybe it turns out I'm a metaphysical materialist and an ethical hedonist. And what does that mean for my actual life through the lens of what's going on in my world ecologically, like literally where I live and where I spend my time? What actions and behaviors are then cogent and coherent and holistic for me to take on the basis of that construction of reality? Does that make sense?
I love what you're saying. Just a little off point, I just have to say something that I've never said on radio, but I've been wanting to. The whole idea of grading people in education, mm-hmm. I think is generally a bad idea. And I know I was kind of a brilliant young man, but got so impatient with this kind of rote memorization method I was forced to sit through many years. But when I finally got out of high school and into college, I would like audit courses before I, like if I want to do philosophy or history, I would go visit half a dozen classes, see which professor really excited me and take his or her class. Mm-hmm. So my college years were so fascinating, and I found, oh, I actually like history. I love this stuff. I love English, but I was subjected to such awful teachers through the years that I got turned off to these subjects. So first of all, one thing educators should do is not turn off their students to what they're teaching. Don't leave them hating the subject. Two, like give students choices and back off the whole grading thing and present methods that are interesting. Well, like you're doing, it's so engaging and fun. You just wanna learn. And this is where people learn the best, when they connect with a teacher or appreciate a style and there's some choice in the matter. So anyway, I had to get that in off topic, but that's actually what that's your method.
No, that's precisely the topic. It really is. I mean, I derive a lot of joy and value from etymologies, like the origin of given words. And sometimes the irony discovered in a given etymology is very elucidatory and instructive as to the upside downness of society as it now is. Consider this, the word school, which I think if you say school to the person on the street or like to the person who's in school right now, whether they're old or young, they go, okay, yeah, that's something I'm having to do for some particular purpose, having to do, like a sense of obligation. But originally what school meant, it comes from this Greek word skole, which in ancient Greek means leisure. It's what you do with your leisure time. School means free time. It's what you do if the basic needs of life, the other things that you have to do in order to not die, have already been met, or if you live in some sort of social configuration where those needs are met for you. So it's like if you're not working the field or actively, you know, fighting a war with somebody who's trying to invade your city-state, you are involved in skole. And what do you do with your skole? You get together with other people and you cultivate ideas through song or discussion or what have you, and then gradually it came to mean this institution as the first philosophical schools, quote unquote, came into being. But even those originally were these clubs, basically, where you're getting together to chop it up with people about what you care about. And the fact that we've turned it into really the opposite of that, the opposite of free time, the thing that you want to get done with as soon as possible so that you can then do what you're actually passionate about, it's just an ironic thing.
Very well said. Like, we are naturally curious creatures, and we naturally want to learn. It's just like, don't pound it into students' head. Don't pound the information in. Let curiosity and people's own excitement guide their educational process.
Yes.
But anyway, to the topic on hand, let's get serious and make this very productive. Let's be effective with our time
here. Okay, yeah. Enough of this frivolity.
Enough of this silliness. Okay. We're at a point of humanity that's critical, ecological. I mean, in 20 different realms, we're kind of at this catastrophe point, but particularly ecologically, in many, many areas, we're on the verge of collapse in a lot of areas. And when one thing starts collapsing, it's going to be domino effect, and just very quickly, it's going to be system collapse. But so many people are making money off of this impending doom that it's very hard to stop it. It's like if we're on a big ship, but the big powerful people are making money off of pulling planks off of the hull to burn it or sell it. You know, the whole thing's going to go down, and when it does, it's going to be too late. So profit, greed, you know, predatory capitalism, I think, obviously, is at the heart of the difficulty we're having in changing the direction. There's one other religious issue, but that's critical too. But let's go into the profit over conscience issue.
Yeah, I think that ship metaphor is a very compelling one. I'd never heard that before, but it's apt. It's humorous and it's apt. I think that's a good characterization of the situation. I got kind of hypnotized by the image of it. What would you like me to add to it? Is it like, what's the solution?
Well, because so many people are making money off of destroying things, I mean, this is like the core issue. How does one approach this to solve this seemingly intractable problem?
Yeah, it does feel sometimes intractable. This is one of that feeling of intractability is one of the things that this philosophy course is trying to tangle with and be really honest about, because I think it's very easy to, this is something I encounter when I'm operating in spaces of like ecological activism and environmental awareness and sustainability and stuff. Sometimes in precisely those conversations, we indulge in a kind of phony optimism or a phony sense of, oh, we got it all figured out, or like, look at all the progress we're making. But really the dread that comes with it is something that we should look at sincerely and go like, okay, why are we really feeling this way? And look honestly at the scope of the difficulty. And I think one of the difficulties, or perhaps the central difficulty, is exactly as you put it. It's the money solution. And it's, or the idea that money could somehow dig us out of a problem that money created, or that technology could dig us out of a problem that technology created. The faith that the average person on the street seems to have in the apparatus of the institution, whether it's the state or the federal institution, to just have enough money, have enough tax money or enough corporate money or whatever, to suddenly create some sort of centralized solution that makes it so we're all of a sudden entering a different reality where we're not causing such ecological devastation. I think the faith in that idea is misplaced, because as a matter of fact, we have way more control of our material experience than we typically give ourselves credit for. I just talked to this guy named Alan Raw from the UK. He's putting on this thing called the Humber EcoFest or something like that. Anyway, it's in the region of like Kingston on the Hull, someplace in the UK there. And we were talking about this notion that if you're offering people a way to reinvent their ecological reality, like, hey, you could grow a bunch of your own food, or you could compost your waste, you could turn the waste that you create into an energy source using technologies that we've had for generations, you could do all of those things. Typically, the response will be, well, I can't do that because I have a bottom line to meet immediately. Like, I have a family to feed, or I have certain things that inhibit me from doing that. And so I'm not going to be able to do anything like that. I would approve if the government approved some sort of process that allowed me to participate in that. But until I do that, until such a thing happens, I won't be able to participate. But that's the illusion. The illusion is that we need the middleman or the middle thing of the monetary resource or of the institutional resource in order to directly effectuate the changes that we want to bring about. The power is ours. We can actually do it, which even saying that sounds like some sort of canned thing, because even the slogans like the power is ours or be the change you want to see in the world, the Gandhi quote, they start to ring as false because we've seen them replicated so many times. But it doesn't change the material fact that our actions actually do matter. We're made of matter, and we create cause and effect continua with every single little motion that we make. And so the shift in consciousness that I feel more and more excited about is not a shift toward just being aware of the problem. People have been aware of the problem for a long time, but to shift into direct material action. Like, what are you doing with your actual time? Most cities that, at least in the United States, have robust community garden programs, some of which are funded by the cities, and some of which are just people doing the thing. Usually you can throw a rock at it if you throw a rock in a given direction. That's true in Brooklyn, here where I live. That's true in Los Angeles. That's true in different places in Los Angeles. It's true in South Central Los Angeles. There's a guy I was reading about just the other day who's got a whole like community garden empire that he's begun. Not an empire, but you know, a network. These things are actually happening. And the more we just do it, the less dependence we'll have on the large-scale institutional forces that even once it's congealed and built, then the funding will come from them. But it's become clear that the funding and support is not going to magically trickle down from some sort of centralized authority. That was a really long set of remarks, but I hope it makes some sense.
You actually didn't answer my question. I wanted you to answer in one simple sentence how to stop human greed. But we didn't quite get that one done in one sentence. But but it was a good answer. And
a good wrong answer. Can I take another crack at it?
Well, wait. Let me just comment on what you just said, which is, you say so many important things. You're talking about sloganism and how slogans get co-opted, and then you know companies use that to greenwash as if that solves the problems they're causing. And this idea of faith in technology, like no matter how bad things get, like we'll come up with a solution. Like I just read about how mm-hmm. they're trying to figure out atmospheric manipulation, like spraying sulfuric acid in the sky to absorb more heat. Or like kind of ridiculous solutions when whatever incremental benefit you could get from any of these solutions cannot match the contamination that's being caused. Another example is I'm right near the beach and I see people doing beach cleanup all the time. Yes, clean up the junk on the beach. That's really nice. But if you're collecting a ton over a few months, a ton of garbage, but 20 tons are going into the ocean, well, how is that? I mean, you feel better. It looks better for a few days, but it doesn't solve the problem. And like stopping contamination from happening is much more difficult than just cleaning up stuff. Or the last thing I'll say is, if corporations can get you to recycle cans, they're like outsourcing their responsibility to individuals. Like we should all recycle and do our personal best. But that's just a diversion from the, you know, tons and tons of junk they're pouring into the atmosphere and into the rivers. But they would rather have us spend our time doing recycling. So, oh, anyway, I've just said a lot, too. We'll get to the bigger question of human greed by the end of the show.
We'll put a bookmark in it. By the way, the name of the person I was trying to think of is Ron Finley, the person who his concept, which is not his uniquely, but it just, he's operating in L.A., is guerrilla gardening. The notion that, you know, you don't need to wait or even get anybody's approval. Urban spaces are filled with empty or abandoned or derelict spaces that then can get turned into something where things are growing. But you bring up an important point. The sense of discouragement or hopelessness is not irrational. The notion that no matter how many times you clean up that beach, it's just going to get polluted again. And, you know, there's street cleanups here that I get involved in here in Bushwick in Brooklyn, that same thing happens. There's a sense of the futility of it and that it's not getting to the root of the problem. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that while it is not within our power to systematically overhaul the entire economic system all in one fell swoop, the economic system, for all of its pernicious effects does respond, and the governmental system, for all of its pernicious failings, does respond to people's behavior, and it responds to collective behavior. We just passed laws in New York City recently that make it so you have to ask people when they're ordering takeout if they want the extra stuff that usually comes with takeout. That law would not have passed if there was not a consciousness shift and a behavioral shift within the citizenry to justify a move of that kind. Similarly with our municipal composting program. They took it away a few years ago, and then community composters rose to the occasion and started doing so much composting that the city can't help but recognize that this thing is happening either way. And once the thing is happening either way, then it gets behind it. The leadership, and this is like a very like core sort of democratic ethos thing, the leadership ultimately does consist in our ability to form, even anarchically, into little pockets of community action. And then that community action ideally gets supported by the larger institutions that we're all a part of. But the polarity, I think, in our thinking is typically reversed, that we have to wait around for some solution because the problems are so big. So to go back to like the trash on the street, if 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now is the, we start to see seismic shifts in what companies do and don't do by virtue of a response to a massive cultural shift in terms of what we actually value, then we can start thinking about the, thinking hopefully about the scalability of these solutions. I'll admit on a day-to-day level, you pick up the litter, it comes back. On a day-to-day level, you can only grow a small amount of the food that you yourself even need to consume as a human or as a small community that you're a part of, and the rest of it still needs to get shipped from someplace else. But if you begin to take a bite out of the market share and the time and energy share and the consciousness share that the giant corporatocratic apparatus has on our current lives, then you taking a little bite adds up with the other little bites that people are taking, and eventually things shift. And we see things shift. We know that things can shift in other areas. It's not just by some sort of magical force that network television begins to lose out to streaming services. It's not just by some magical shift that more centralized sources of news begin to lose out to social media networks. Now, granted, those new things that immediately democratize can then in turn get corporatized and corrupted. That's another problem. But we know that shifts are possible. Anything that seems too big to be dismantled is in fact dismantleable. We see this constantly. And the only way that the dismantling happens is if we, as individuals that then in turn form larger communities, and then those communities form larger communities, start to take those actions. And so it's, if I was to like sort of model it in a really broad sense, and then this broad modeling even has a metaphysical sort of corollary to it, instead of outside in thinking, where we're going, wow, the problem is vast and caused by mega corporations and by governments, we need those mega corporations and governments to fix it. True, that is where the moral responsibility lies. That is absolutely where the abstract question of justice points in terms of whose fault it is. Absolutely their fault. But just because it's somebody's fault doesn't mean they're actually going to act on it. And unfortunately, those structures only respond to the actual movements of the parts that are considered from the inside out. The cells make up the bodies make up the community makes up the group, the larger group, the nation state, what have you. And there is a sort of unfortunate conflation, I think, where because it seems so hopeless, and because there is justified moral outrage toward the large-scale causers of the problem, that it hoodwinks us into thinking that we can't actually do anything. But fortunately slash unfortunately, we can and we must. You know what I mean?
Beautifully put. And I am actually pitching you some hard balls here, and you're hitting them out of the park. I don't mean to be the grumpy old man, you know, who lets the idea of the perfect be the enemy of the good. And the good is picking up trash on the beach and planting a garden and recycling your candy. That's good. And that's, it's helps in incremental ways. And I would refer to a big media campaign I saw in, I guess, the 70s, that the glass and bottling companies put out a lot of ads that said, every litter bit hurts. And this was all over the media. Like, people maybe had this idea of just like throwing stuff, you know, in the parks or on the beach or something, or on, but now, like, we're supposed to put our garbage in cans. This was a big campaign. But we figured out over a few years that, oh, this was to distract the public, to outsource the bottling company's responsibility to recycle and so forth to the individual. So we worried more about doing our job, and so we wouldn't point the finger at them. However, this is the point I'm getting to. When everybody starts picking up their trash, eventually they go, well, hey, industry, we're doing our part. Now you do yours. So it kind of has a blowback effect eventually. And the more people are recycling and doing gardens and the more they're going to naturally start looking at the bigger issue. So that getting on the ladder of awareness leads to more awareness, and then eventually doing the hard stuff like passing laws and getting people elected who are reputable and really stand up for these important causes. So yes, what you're saying is great. It's positive. It's absolutely do this. The stuff that's within your ability, that's in front of you, start there. But it can and hopefully should lead to the big society-wide changes that really alter the whole environment for the good.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it, and you know, and I'm glad you brought up the cans and bottles, because you're right. It's, you know, the confusion generated by those ultimately highly dubious campaigns from the 70s, like the one you're talking about, and like the crying Indian, if you remember that infamous ad, who apparently was not even Indian, he was Italian. But the confusion that that has caused is considerable, because there's also a deeper level to go to. And it's, you know, this is why I'm glad you brought up the cans and bottles. You know, consider a can. This becomes like a phenomenological thing. And by phenomenological, I mean just considering things in their raw, you know, the raw data of human experience. A can is not your friend. It's made to be turned into something else. It's maybe better than a plastic sippy cup that can't even be turned into anything else because of the grade of plastic that it is. It's just going to outlast even you, and it's not even going to go to another use. But aluminum, too, isn't really your buddy, and you can kind of feel it. I mean, if you are in a psychedelic frame of mind, you can sometimes feel this even on an experiential level. But even without that, you can just feel it. It's not your permanent buddy. As you gaze around like the objects in your house, if you look at like grandma's mug that's been handed down through generations, and you look at even something that is made of plastic, like maybe if you're a musician, like your recording gear, maybe your microphone is like partly plastic or something, the casing, whatever, part of it's aluminum, what have you. It's not about the substances themselves. It's about the intention that goes into them. And then it has a kind of aura. So recycling, it is an example of something that's not what I mean by individual action. That's the shadow of individual action, or the co-opted surface version of individual action. Everybody crush their cans and make sure they put their recycling in the right place. The deeper individual action is, I don't need that in the first place. When I go get my cup of coffee, I bring my own cup, which is not just me being cute and doing a zero waste thing for Instagram. That's literally a revolutionary claim on the sanctity and autonomy and sort of metaphysical kindredness with a given object, in the sense of, this is something that I care about. My care in this world extends to this cup, which is a permanent companion of mine. You can see this with, you know, you read like ancient poetry where you had, you know, heroes and warriors and things giving gifts to one another. They gave gifts of material objects more often than money to exchange to obtain disposable objects, because there's an actual sense of care. It's another entity in the world. Somebody crafted it. It has value. It exudes and drips value. Whereas even a recyclable thing, if it's made to be used once and then turned into something else, that's only a little bit better than something that's made to be used once and then thrown away. Because either way, it's a culture of disposability. So the reason to clean the beach isn't because the beach isn't going to get dirty again, but because we value the beach. And the reason to bring your own cup isn't because the cup is you know, a sentient object necessarily, although maybe there's a claim for its constituent parts being sentient. That's, you know, a department of philosophy that will claim that. But it's because the cup can get used again. It has value in and of itself, just like a person has value in and of themselves. And so if our value, our valuation of the world starts to be about having care for the actual real material things that are, rather than the notion that anything merits being instantly destroyed or transformed into something else as quickly as possible, then we're taking these steps of individual action that actually do add up, rather than steps of individual action that are merely a mask for us being part of an ongoing process of commodification and even self-commodification. You know what I'm saying?
Wow. By the way, I'm talking with Nathan Dufour. He can be easily found on social media as Nathanology, right?
Yep, perfect. Yeah, Nathanology, like the study of Nathan.
Poet, producer, professor, art about philosophy, ecology, and mental health. These are great videos you're posting.
Thanks.
Let me make things even more difficult for you now. Like, we still have to solve the issue of human greed. But like,
yes.
We're going to get to that in the last couple of minutes. But let me add in another factor that I don't know how many people are aware of this. This is a really complex issue, and it's religion. And the issue is, for those who aren't aware of this, that there's a large body of, well, mostly evangelicals or fundamentalists who believe this world is inherently problematic. It's sinful. It's here to be consumed. And the only real goodness comes after we're dead. The blessed get swooped up to heaven for where they go for eternity. And the rest of us, I would guess me, burn in some kind of radioactive hell for eternity. And for a long time, these people were pushing, I'm not making this up, it's just not widely discussed, they were pushing nuclear war in the Middle East and doing what they could to build up Israel so it could be some kind of sacrificial lamb where World War III starts, where it all gets destroyed and the world gets destroyed and the blessed people get swooped up to heaven. This is not fiction. Just, you can dig into this a little, and this is what millions of people believe. But they've extended this kind of apocalyptic theology now to climate change. And like, well, maybe it won't come through nuclear war. Maybe it'll come through ecological disaster. Fine with us. So there's a large body of religious people, millions of people who are in climate change denial and pushing to actually wipe out the planet through ecological destruction. Now, this isn't human greed. This is a religious belief. And, you know, it at some level, it's about love and God and devotion. But to the rest of us, it's just appalling. Okay, I made things more difficult for you, Nathan. Comment.
No, I'm glad that you brought it up because it is deeply connected to what we were just talking about, and it may indeed, I guess we'll see, get us to our greed answer if we ever end up getting there, but we don't need to be greedy. We'll get what we can get. The question is one of value. It's, if it is indeed my metaphysical presupposition that the material world is somehow something to devalue because it is so far transcended by the ultimate reality, by the reality of heaven or the kingdom of God, which lies beyond it, whatever, then yeah, if my values are going to map onto my actions, then I say, okay, yeah, so this doesn't matter. However, you could get to the same indifference, the same total disregard for the interrelations that constitute the material world of creatures and inorganic entities, even of the whole material process. I could get to the same code of indifference, the same total disregard, if I were starting from the opposite metaphysical presupposition that, let's say, a nihilistic worldview, that it is all just empty matter, that anything that I care about just because I decide to care about it. Maybe I'm a radical materialist existentialist in this sense, and I don't think that there's any meaning or value in the world because it's all just little bits of particulate matter that just happen to collide or aggregate in just thus in such a way, and so it's all meaningless. And the only meaning that there is the meaning that I create. And therefore, the only people whose meaning ends up being prominent are the people who create meaning and have the will to make it be so, and the will to power, if you will. That's a radical secularism that then becomes a disregard for other forms of life, or other human life, or other organic life. That Nazism is a famous example of this. And so any value system can be contorted and warped in such a way, or applied in such a way, that there ends up being a disregard for interrelations between organic entities, whether they be people or other creatures or things like that. I think that either way, the warping in that direction happens when we lose the immediacy of the mystery of actually being here. Because my construction of my value system is actually secondary to that original encounter with the other, whether the other is another living, breathing human, or whether the other is one of the cups that I was talking about earlier, which is just another aggregation of matter, just like myself. And there is just relationship there in the first place. And the thing that jettisons us from relationship is the process, I think, of abstraction and commodification that turns things into just things, or really ultimately turns things into just ideas that I'm not actually in relationship with. And this is something that's happened in secular philosophies and in the secular materialist underpinning of modern American consumer society. It's happened also in the context of evangelical Christianity, if the examples that you're providing are in fact things that are going on, and I can believe that they are. But Christianity does not inherently lead there. Neither does metaphysical materialism. Neither of them inherently lead there. I mean, by contrast with, you know, evangelical Protestantism, the Catechism of the Catholic Church is super emphatic about, well, God made the world, and so the world is something to be valued. You're in fact in service to it. Because Catholicism, with its really ancient roots, really goes back to and is connected to and remains philosophically connected to the pagan schools that it mixed with when it was first coming into being, Stoicism and Platonism especially, which had the notion that while there are elements that transcend the material world is still something of value because it is a reflection of the creation of the divine. There is divinity in it. There is even soul coursing through every single little constituent part of it, down to the quantum. And so it's not inherently any value system that leads to these destructive practices. I would more say the destructive practices arise when there's not a really immediate relationship with reality and the mystery of reality. And another way to put that would be when there is not an educational experience that invites us to actually apply our perception of the ultimate values to their terminus points in our behavior. And that goes back right to the beginning of what we were talking about, that we don't have an education system that encourages that kind of encounter, that kind of encounter with our ideas and our beliefs and our values, and that kind of immediate apprehension of the mystery of the strange relationship that we find ourselves entangled in simply by existing. Does that make sense?
A good answer from a philosopher to a very difficult question. Even kind of asking that on the radio is going to ruffle some feathers and get me a lot of hate mail. But this is, as I say, millions of people are signed up for this theology right now. So, and I would imagine in their world, well, you know, well-intentioned people, good people, not greedy or awful, but just they have a view which is really distorted and deviant. And I think it's actually okay. I'm gonna get all philosophical on you. Boom, watch this.
Let's do it.
A symptom, not that what I'm gonna say is so radical, but it's a symptom of a disintegration of society. People are flailing, people are confused. All the old structures that people could rely on, family and government, and everything's kind of falling apart. And it's very easy to be seduced by cultism, by easy answers, by fanaticism, by violent theologies. Just do what I say, you know, it'll solve all the great dictators and authoritarian thugs come up this way. Just obey me and I will make everything all right. In a sense, to get even a little more Jungian about it, it's a disintegration of the father force. Like, the father, there's no father, and we're running rampant, and there's no, so we then accept father figures who beat their chest in this very baboonish kind of jungle, you know, bestial persona. Being enamored with the end of the world, like that's going to solve our problems, is a symptom. It's a symptom of a collapse of values, and it's people looking for an easy answer. So at the biggest level, and maybe now we can hit the greed issue, it's like it's a time for new ideas, really, and new visions. And that's kind of why people like you are so vital and so exciting to come upon, because, I mean, I don't know that you have all the answers, but you're putting out a lot of ideas, and it's creative, and it's fun, and it's engaging and challenging, and causing, well, me to think a lot, and challenge me even just in my art. The way you present your material is just so compelling. So, okay, we're inching towards answering the great questions of humanity right now.
I like that we're getting close. I appreciate the kind words. I mean, yeah, I'm inspired that you asked that question, because it gets to the heart of what I find most interesting. And I don't have all the answers about this, but, you know, ironically, I don't think we need less theology, though. We need more and deeper theology. And also, by the flip side, when we ask ourselves questions that would perhaps lead to the opposite kinds of answers, or when we oppose theology with, let's say, like radical existential attitudes, we don't need less of those either. We need more of those radical existential attitudes and deeper ones. And what I mean by that, just to rephrase hopefully more succinctly what I was saying before and what some of what you're pointing to with what you just said, is it's not to me even about new ideas. It's about closing the gap between values and ideas and actual actions, which is more what ancient forms of wisdom from pick a given culture of which we have record, more what ancient forms of wisdom had in mind. The early Christians were really radical. They were really radical because it was an idea that spread from the Judaic context into Asia Minor, and it was people who were literally withdrawing from the typical processes of everyday society and living kind of commune style in a really radical and new way. Why? Well, with the expectation that a major metaphysical shift had taken place in the fabric of reality, a new eschatological reality had suddenly emerged, such that no longer doing the usual was now the obvious thing to do. It was the same kind of suspension of the usual that was forced upon consciousness in the modern world by the pandemic in mini form, in the sense like, okay, everything is totally different for now, except it's permanently different. Now, compare those early Christians to folks who were even roughly contemporary with them, or just a little bit earlier, the ancient Epicureans. Totally different metaphysical claim. They didn't think that God had anything to do with reality. They thought that reality was just matter, and the best thing to do was to heighten pleasure and avoid pain. But as it turns out for them, the best way to heighten pleasure and avoid pain was to live very simply. And so in a very similar gesture, they did the same thing. They withdrew from the BS of what was going on in the political superstructure of the Greco-Roman social context, and instead of more of the same, did something much more radical, radical in the sense of literally back to the roots of reality, and lived in simple commune form, much like the early Christians would do, for totally different reasons. But in both cases, it's a return to reality by virtue of actually trying to close the gap between your confrontation with the mystery of reality and its immediacy and your actual behavior, where you just go, okay, yeah, wow, I'm really here. And I really do believe that spirit and God suffuses everything, whatever that ineffable ultimate source reality is. Therefore, I am not going to run for office like I've been encouraged to do, and make a bunch of $1 million like I've been encouraged to do, and create a bunch of waste like I've been encouraged to do, and not look back. Or, wow, there is nothing but this strange immediate matter that I have, whether there's God or not. Okay, based on that strangeness, I'm going to really reevaluate how I live and care about the matter that I'm made of, and care about the material relations that constitute my existence. Again, to be more succinct, it's about creating a unity, an immediate unity of value and action.
I like it. We're digging in here. Well, because we're sharing our answers here, I think things change, and I kind of just said it, because of new visions, because through the arts, because of powerful ideas that change people and that are fun. And I think at some point the new information is just shifts everything, so all the death and violence worshiping cults and the religious domination cults, people kind of turn around and go like, yeah, that's just stupid. You know, it's just kind of silly. Like, next, goodbye. Like, it's just old crap. And it just gets put up behind us. It doesn't come through some big war, good and evil. It's just that the new information is so much better and sweeter that the old junk just kind of sloughs off. That's how I see things change, including this greed underlying a lot of it.
Yeah, we return once again to this greed thing. And I don't know, I guess I've never just looked at the question squarely. What is the source of greed? And what is greed? I guess the desire to aggregate to oneself a surplus of what one needs to continue to exist and to continue to be well. And then what underlies that, I presume, is a failure to recognize that even you are not really ultimately a finite thing. You're not an individual, but a dividual, a thing that is made up of smaller things. And that's true whether you view the smaller things as being suffused with and an expression of or reducible to some sort of spiritual substance or divinity. And it's true if you abstract in the other direction and think of yourself as being made up of a bunch of mechanically interrelated bits of matter that are operating deterministically. Either way, you aren't just you. You're a society of stuff. And if you wanna pretend that you're finite and independent, and you wanna play the weird game of clutching really hard onto a bunch of stuff that you're trying to hold in your hands so that other beings that are themselves societies and aggregations can't exist, then it just seems less fun. It just seems like it makes less sense.
All right, well, I'll throw in mine that the greed, it's kind of what you're saying in a sense. It's this hoarding of trinkets,
yeah,
which makes you actually more isolated because now you got to protect all your stuff that everybody wants. So you become more isolated, but this is an attempt to replace the gaping hole left when there's a lack of intimacy, community, and kindness. Those things are really the valuable things to experience. Intimacy and art and loving people and sex and play. This is actually wonderful and makes life rich. But instead of those cool things, we're just gathering these shiny objects to try to fill that void.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's well put. Trinkets is a good key word. And you don't find yourself jealously gathering and guarding trinkets when you're in your best frame of mind, when you are living well and loving well and flowing well and jamming well. You just, I don't think you tend to do that as often when you're in your pocket. And yeah, I think that's well put.
I think in the old days, in tribal times, the most important people of the village were the ones who gave the most, the ones who cared for others. They had great honor and esteem.
Yeah, I think that is true. And it once again brings us to that educational thing that in the primordial experience prior to the conditions of civilization as we now encounter it, there's a kind of authenticity that it seems like we collectively feel like we have lost, where the exchange of information, the exchange of energy, the exchange of resources had an organic gift logic to it. And the gift economy, as it's now sometimes retrospectively called, and that insofar as we can create new structures that are not in fact new, but really are reinstantiations of that same dynamic, we are going forward in our new technologies, our new genres of art, our new genres of self, but also recovering something that we've lost since then, or that it's become easier to lose since then.
Nathan Dufour, PhD. People can find you at Nathanology on most social media.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a very engaging discussion, and I hope the first of many.
I would enjoy that, Pete. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed the talk.
Thank you so much for your time.
All right, so long.
All right, class, we're going to get started. Everyone, please don't take your seats. Close your textbook. Stand up and dance to this song. What do you think of when I use the word school? You might shrug your shoulders and be like, school. It's a needful but imperfect institutional tool to make the people on the planet not be absolute fools. Or you might have the view that it's only half true what they teach, and that in truth it's a tool that uses you. It's subject to abuse, and the subjects you take are designed to make your mind subjects of the state. Some say it's great though, A-OK, and the best way to go is to go and get A's. But whether you be for it or don't see it as best, society demands that you go or you're effed. When we were kids, we would sing this hook. No more pencils, no more books. When they made us go to school. And yet in the days when the tradition began, way before the institutions and the social demand, the ancient Greek skole, from which school is rendered, did not mean work you had to do, it meant leisure.
What?
Leisure? Yes, sir. Free time. Yes, if you had food to eat and other needs didn't press, you might read or write if you like, free of stress. So yes, in a sense, school meant recess. You might spend your time with the Socrates and talk thoughtfully about God and being, and contemplate the concepts of cosmic things without an obligation or college fees. And speaking of ironic etymologies, education from the Latin educare means to lead out from, not to sit inside. And study meant passion for a task, yeah right. Now you might ask why, like, bro, what the f***? How did it all become the opposite of what it was? School meant days off, study meant fun. Why is it upside down? I'm confounded, it's dumb. Welcome to the club, are you really surprised? Humans have a tendency to systematize, and the systems are fine until the systems are blind to the very human beings for whom the system's designed. It's a means to an end. In the end, that means that whoever's at the head gets to set the meanings and assign the readings and to set the times and to regulate the rhythm of our lives and minds. But way before pencils and way before books and way before the tests that everybody took, there was old school
Word.
All right, let's go ahead and walk outside down and put our hands in the soil. Don't forget your improvised song is due at any time. It ain't about your inches, kid, it's how you get her done. Better aggregate your passions into learning outcomes. Don't be burning out, son, reevaluate your goals. Gotta crack another statue from the economic mold. Got you docile till you're old. They don't want us to know. But the thing about them is that they is us, bro. Life's short, learning slow. Why go back to the source when you could simply get it secondhand, a requisite course? And yes, you're being forced, and while at times it may be free, so is all your social media. It's not that hard to see that that's another way of saying the commodity's me, and the product is becoming what they want me to be.
Some people say that the Earth has been ruined. Some people say it's the fault of some humans. Other people say we had nothing to do with it. Both sides say the other side is stupid. But what might be more helpful than saying it isn't me, or saying it was you, is to look at the history and see how the whole cluster was begun, and to stop being abusive and to get something done. And so what follows is a history of environmental policy in the United States. Back about 1962, we learned the pesticide that we use on our food is bad for the earth and bad for the brain. It's called dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane. So from 63 up to 65, they passed bilateral laws to keep us alive, to check pollution levels and to dial them back, called the Water Quality and the Clean Air Acts. Now a couple years later, in 68, a lot of hippies left cities to make their own place, living off-grid by a river and lakes inspired by a picture of Earth from outer space. But at the same timer, in 69er, there were pillars of smoke from a chemical fire that kept getting higher and hotter and bigger because the oil on the surface of the Cuyahoga River. And so everyone, hippies or not, felt that it was time to make a change. And so on April 22nd at the start of the 70s, since Earth was feeling kind of more hellish than heavenly, the people had a lot of strong words to say, and the government agreed to call a day Earth Day. But since having a day doesn't automatically fix it, a new agency came from none other than Nixon. He called it the EPA. He put it on while on a break from dropping more bombs on Vietnam. And in 73 and 74, the Arabs with oil said oil no more because of Israel's war, which kind of took us to shul because we finally got started thinking about alternative fuel. But things got worse before they got greater, because the same year we learned that the ozone layer was forming a hole at a very broad span because the chlorofluorocarbons out of aerosol cans. Up till then, most people thought the ozone was synonymous with the G-spot. It's not. And since emission levels still steadily climbed, then President Carter back in 79 said by 2000 fuel will be 20% clean, but that actually took us until 2018. Jimmy said he'd be the first to try it out and put solar panels on the top of the White House, but later Ronald Reagan said... The truth is a fact, a fib is a fiction. A theory is a clear and objective description of that which exists, how it is, how it isn't, by history or science or some defined discipline. And so theory goes. If you hold the opinion that truth is so easily known and envisioned. But what if, quote, truth as you know it is hidden by myths you've been told that you don't know you're living? What if powers that be control how the truth's given, and even how science and history are written, and even the means of theorizing's conditioned by the interest of those in the power position? Well, in that case, our theories would need criticism. And this is called critical theory. Its mission to sift out the and call out the system. What system is it? It's capitalism.
Roll your paradise, make your paradigms, break no paradigms, they tell me this is paradise.
It started with a question within Marxism. Is the revolution working? Oh, darn it isn't. Well, the Bolsheviks revolted, the autocrats co-opted it, but the problem's not communists, the problem is consciousness. For all we can think is what we have known, and all we've ever known is that things can be owned, and to bite, scratch, and claw to get your possessions. And life is a bitch if dog eat dog's your first premise. It's get what you get since the get-go, it's endless. The notion's so close we don't notice its presence. Every system we inscribe reinstated its essence in hieroglyphs, Bibles, and declarations of independence. All of our relations, a human and their nation, a human and another human, a human and mother nature, are reduced to an equation of consumeristic labor. You know what I'm saying? You get what you pay for.
My ancestors own people, my creditors own me though. It's not the same thing, but there's many kinds of evil. But we don't even overthrow the powers that be though, cause we really don't even know how to be free. Oh, and even if we did know how, would we want to be? Don't we want jobs and a solid economy? People gotta eat, it's Nathan's hot dogs or me. We've got it all, but it's all ideology.
The system may seem natural, but it keeps you in place. It makes it seem natural to work cheap at a pizza place. It makes it seem natural to divide the species by class and race. It makes it seem unnatural to stop and seek peace and grace. Nothing against pizza. Pizza's delicious, but the idea that you need it is cheesy and insidious. No matter how you slice it, we're defined by our interests in a circle of supply and demand, which is vicious. And I may understand this and say it in rap spits and pray my supply matches what your demand is. Yet I must admit, in spite of this rap song, even I had to buy Das Kapital on Amazon. Ain't that ironic? You called it Alanis. You call yourself leftist, you're probably capitalist. Not that you don't mean your call out sincerely. This irony is acknowledged by critical theory.
Roll your paradise, take your paradigms. Break no paradigms, prepare to die in paradise. I only knew how.
To the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed the extraordinary Nathan Dufour, and then I played samples from his brilliant song Raps, first Old School School, then A History of Environmental Policy in the U.S., and just wrap things up with An Introduction to Critical Theory. He can be reached at Nathanology on social media. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Misty Pete out.